Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's Monday morning, and that means it's time for the movie reviews, as we do every Monday morning. And it's Monday, that means my dad is going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. And in honor of one of the best concerts I've ever seen in my life over this weekend, Pearl Jam at Wrigley Field, and the fact they are playing again tonight, and if you are going, you're very lucky. We're going to talk about the best live bands and live musical artists of all time. I got a Rolling Stone list that we'll go through. And also, if you want to call in and talk about some of the best concerts you've ever seen, we're going to do that as well. Our phone number, as always, is 312-981-7200. For talk and text, 312-981-7200. You can check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected, though, is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, every Monday morning, we review the movies with Eric Childress and Colin Suter, both from eFilmCritic.com. RogerEbert.com, and we also talk about the box office with Eric, who does a box office analysis that appears every Monday morning at movies.com. And we always bring Eric and Colin in to talk about the new movies, and that's what we're going to do right now. And here's Eric. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hi, Colin.
Hello there.
How are you?
Good.
Good. Cool. All right. Not a lot to talk about this week. Only three films, really. I do want to mention, Eric, you went to the Bruce Campbell Horror Film Festival, correct?
Yes, I did.
And did you just see the one movie?
Yes. I mean, I saw a bunch of movies, but I saw the one particularly. I saw the world premiere Saturday night.
Yeah, now tell everybody about that. This is a movie that actually a common friend of ours.
Mr. Scott Weinberg has been a colleague of ours for many, many years, going back to the beginnings of E-Film Critic, in fact.
And, he's been on the show. He's been on the show. Yep.
Yeah, been on the show, and he co-produced this film called Found Footage 3D. And the film is basically, it's a film that, the setup of the film is sort of, you know, sort of taking the idea that, you know, a lot of found footage movies have sucked over the years, and you have this sort of the really, you know, skeleton crew of filmmakers who are getting together to film what they believe is going to be, you know, a found footage movie to end all found footage movies. And the star of the movie, who's also the writer of the script, decides that he's going to have the film shot in 3D. What this means for anything is really nothing, because why would you shoot a found footage movie in 3D?
Right.
Why would someone film their vacation video in 3D?
Right.
So you have, you know, a lot of sort of these meta jokes going on throughout the movie. You know, why do people, you know, not put the camera down when they're, you know, they're attacked by these certain things? And they go off to shoot this movie in an abandoned house deep in the woods where something horrible might have cause this house to be haunted.
Right. So your basic found footage setup.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, right.
And as they're filming the movie, some, you know, weird things begin to happen, as is the case in all found footage movies.
Right.
So you have a movie that, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, sort of trying to be like the Scream of found footage movies in a way, a movie that is mocking the conventions but at the same time embracing them to, you know, be its own thing. And the film really works. It really kind of surprised me just how well the film works. And a big reason for that is that the movie actually pays attention to the characters. It's not just a bunch of archetypes, even just making fun of the horror conventions where you got, like, you know, you have a jackass, you have a bimbo, you know. It doesn't, you know, play those sort of conventions out. Instead, it actually sets up, like, you know, characters that are, you know, pretty interesting, characters that have motivations and priorities to what they're actually doing, you know, doing this thing for. There's definitely comic relief on the part, but it's all rooted in an actual reality. And the film, you know, the real life and the found footage, or the, you know, whatever's going on in the house, there's sort of like a parallel stream that's going on throughout the movie that actually is, you know, pretty interesting. And so it's funny, and then when it starts to get horrific, it works. I cared about the characters, which is something you can almost never say in found footage movies, let alone even a lot of horror movies. And then the film, it really does work. It really it surprised me in a number of ways that, you know, I thought it was just going to be kind of a fun little movie that riffed on all these kind of things and then sort of devolved into its own thing. But it really works as one of the better examples of how to do a found footage movie.
Wow, that's great. And so now it's not in 3D.
Yeah, it is in 3D.
Oh, it is in 3D. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, it actually is in 3D. And one of the sort of the fun things about the movie, and the movie doesn't really comment about it, is that it kind of, even though it's in 3D and obviously is a big part of it, for one, the 3D actually looks really good.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it really kind of shows you just how purposeless the 3D actually is. They're not really doing a lot of, like, 3D tricks or anything like that. It's just kind of there.
Yeah. Okay.
So without really commenting on it, it's kind of showing
right.
how worthless 3D actually is.
Right. That's
but at the same time, you know, doing it really well.
So now this was part of the Bruce Campbell Horror Film Festival that happened this weekend as part of Wizard World. And we had the director of the festival on earlier this or last week
mm-hmm.
To preview. Now, what else did you see while you were there?
They showed a film that we'll be talking about next week. It opened with Don't Breathe.
Yeah, Don't Breathe,
yeah,
which is
so we'll be talking about that at great
yeah,
length.
No, that's that movie is the most anticipated movie for me.
Yeah. Oh, you haven't seen it yet?
No, I have not seen it yet.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, I know. I cannot wait to see it.
I got the peek in on the right before the found footage premiere. They still screened a Monster Squad.
Oh yeah, sure. And Fred Decker was there.
Yeah. So and they did Night of the Creeps there earlier
right.
too, because Fred Decker was there in
right.
attendance and a couple of the cast members from Monster Squad. So I got to peek in on the Q&A after the movie, which is a movie that I haven't seen it in a long time, but that's a movie that I've never been down with.
No, me neither. And I got to tell you. I'm a little older.
Yeah.
But I was very excited about it because just the idea, growing up with all the Universal movies.
Of course.
Just the idea of having all of those guys in one movie, but I thought it was a missed opportunity. And I forgot that Shane Black wrote it.
Me too.
I totally forgot. Colin, how do you feel about Monster Squad, Colin?
I'm kind of the same way, and I saw it again 10 years ago, I think, something like that, at one of those music box.
Oh, the massacre thing, yeah.
I don't think it was a massacre. I think it was a sci-fi thing, but maybe it was a massacre. But yeah, and I kind of had that feeling, too. And it was like, you know, watching it with a really enthusiastic crowd who was loving it. And I was kind of like, I know I should love it, but it just kind of misses. It's not bad. It just kind of misses the mark.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too. I was always kind of disappointed with it.
Yeah.
All right, so you got to see a little bit of Monster Squad. Did you get to say hi to Barbara Crampton?
No, I didn't get to say hi to her, but I saw her walking around.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to be the guy like, hey, remember I met you 2 years ago?
Right.
I didn't want to be that guy.
Right.
You know, she's got enough of those guys coming up to her already.
Sure, yeah.
So I was looking for an opportunity, and I just kind of saw her walking around.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, and overall, I heard it was a there were friends of mine who were there like all weekend. And kept posting.
Yeah, no, the
crowd
was
stuff.
Crowd was good. I heard all about the really good crowds that weekend. William Sadler was there today. They showed Bill and Ted's Bogus
Journey. Yeah, I know, man.
Which I missed.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, the crowds were good, and I'm just really happy that the found footage 3D was good, and it's actually being very well received by the people. People ate it up last night for sure.
Okay.
Weinberg knows that I can be a very harsh critic of horror.
You're right.
Sometimes, and he was kind of biting his nails about what I was going to think about it.
Yeah.
And I was the first to go shake his hand.
Well, that's
right
great.
Afterwards,
that's great. And and obviously that's going to be looking for a release of some kind and a distributor of some kind, and it'll probably just will it play some fests, I would imagine, coming up?
I imagine it might play some more fests. I know that they certainly want to come back to Chicago and play some midnight shows and things like that.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine this film. I mean, it's being so well received from the screening last night. I can't imagine that either like an IFC or a Shout Factory or someone aren't going to jump on this thing as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. And it deserves it because I tweeted last night that we see about a found footage movie a week now on VOD, pretty much, and most of them really suck. And this is actually one of the better examples of how to actually make a film, let alone a found footage movie.
That's great. That's great news. Okay, so that's found footage 3D. Look for that one. All right, Eric, Colin, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We've got much more to talk about. New movies, in fact, and we got a break here for the news. And after the news, we'll come back and start the new movie reviews. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. The movie reviews will continue after this. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, followed by the great Steve Cochran at 6. It's Monday. That means my dad will call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we will be talking about some of the best live acts that you could see music-wise. Over the weekend, I went to see Pearl Jam at Wrigley Field, and it was amazing. They're playing tonight again at Wrigley, and if you've got tickets, you're in for a great show, if it's anything like what I saw Saturday night. So we're going to talk about some of the best live bands of all time. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. You can also check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show and Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. It is the movie review time. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me every week to talk movies, and let's get back to it. All right. Hi, guys.
Hello.
All right. Colin, you are the only one.
Yeah.
The only one who made it out to see Ben-Hur.
The whole country?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
We'll get to that a little bit. We'll get to that a little bit later on. But now, and I just wanted to clarify to people, we're not talking about the William Wyler film that won 80 million Academy Awards.
I saw that one.
I saw that one too, yeah. I've seen that one a couple of times, in fact, with Charlton Heston. No, we're talking about the movie from the director of Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. And Colin, you went.
And it's directed with about as much subtlety as a movie called Vampire, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
Right.
So this is the fourth or fifth filmed version of this story. You know, there have been others besides the Charlton Heston.
Yep.
And this stars Jack Houston as Judah Ben-Hur and Toby Cabell as adopted brother Masala. People who don't know the story, they grow up together in Jerusalem, but Masala feels he has no real place there, so he goes off and fights for the Romans and becomes a, you know, top-tier general, while Judah gets mixed up with radicals in his homeland and gets falsely accused of, you know, an assassination attempt. He's enslaved for 5 years in a warship. He survives a battle at sea and eventually returns to his homeland to make things right, find his family, and then race against his brother in the big chariot race. And then meanwhile, throughout all of this, he has run-ins with Jesus, played by Rodrigo Santoro. And he looks, you know, this is the kind of production where Jesus looks more like a Los Angeles masseuse than the Son of God. But then again, that probably shouldn't surprise anyone. Morgan Freeman plays Ildirim, the man who takes Ben-Hur in when he washes ashore and trains him for chariot racing, at which point the movie kind of turns into like this Jerry Bruckheimer Days of Thunder montage of chariot race training scene where Morgan Freeman is the coach. Would it surprise
you to learn
that?
Does he drop the hammer?
Does he drop the hammer? Oh, God.
It probably shouldn't surprise you that Morgan Freeman also narrates the film at the beginning and at the end.
Of course.
Of the film.
Oh, God.
So apparently nobody told these filmmakers that you only hire Morgan Freeman to narrate your movie when you want the audience to laugh in recognition of the sound of Morgan Freeman narrating something again.
Right.
Because he's already parodied himself doing it 6 or 7 times already. You know, he's in on the joke, but these filmmakers apparently are not. And that's the kind of film this is. It is made strictly, it feels like it's made strictly for the chariot race scene, which is, I mean, take the original chariot race scene. It's the one thing, it's the thing that the Heston Ben-Hur is most famous for.
Right.
And rightly so. It holds up today. It is a fantastic scene.
Yep.
There's nothing about it that feels dated. I still, when I watch it, it's like, how did they do this way back, you know, back then? Today, this one, it's modernized with, you know, 3D horses, shaky cam, Morgan Freeman going, good job, Judah, good job, shouting at him, you know, as if Ben-Hur could hear him.
Yeah.
You know, amidst all the chaos. And so and this director has no real clue how to stage any action scene. I mean, not just the chariot race, but also, you know, the battle at sea. You don't know what's going on. You can't get a good grasp on, you know, the geography of where everything is.
This guy has made terrible movies.
Absolutely.
I mean, really terrible. Tell everybody, I mean, the first one that pops into my mind is Wanted, which I hated so much.
Yeah, Wanted, the
And we mentioned
Abraham Lincoln.
We mentioned Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. I'm sorry, I'm trying to bring up his IMDb page to remind myself.
Well, he did the Night Watch and Day Watch, which are some people like, but I don't understand that.
Yeah, and, you know, he's the producer behind Hardcore Henry, which is the worst film I've seen this year. And this is a movie that is, it exists strictly for the spectacle. I mean, it's in 3D. That's how desperate this movie is. And, taking four hours or so to tell a biblical story, I know that's not very fashionable these days, but there's something to be said for something. A movie that, it can take the time to put everything into context so that when Jesus does show up, it feels, organic and it feels justified and it doesn't feel awkward or wedged in. But that's not the case here. It feels, all the Jesus stuff feels like an afterthought. So this is, yet another, bloated, botched, summer blockbuster that is a failure because it is strictly about spectacle and nothing else.
Yeah, God. When I first heard about this, when I first saw the teaser trailer, I was like, "This is a joke, right? I mean, this can't be real." Did the studio behind this? Who's the studio behind
Paramount?
This?
Paramount.
It's Paramount. Okay. Did they? Seriously, think that this was going to be something? I mean,
they must have, because I remember getting the first press releases about it, that this thing was going into production, that this thing was happening. And back then I'm going, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
What are you hoping to accomplish remaking a movie that won 11 Oscars?
Right.
At least one version of the story that won 11 Oscars. See, once you do that, you're done with it.
Yeah.
You shouldn't remake it. And if you're going to do it, and we'll talk about this more with the box office, maybe at least try to entice people with maybe a movie star.
Yeah.
In there. I mean, whatever you want to say about Jack Houston and Toby Kebbell and their previous careers, no one's going to see a movie with these guys.
Right. They're not box office draws. That's for
no.
Sure. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it makes even weird. It makes it even weirder. I mean, they're so desperate with the marketing on this thing, in the week leading up to it, not only do they have a quote from the minister, whose name
Joel Osteen.
Who?
Yeah.
Joel Osteen.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They've got, the quote saying, oh, it's Gladiator meets Fast and the Furious.
Yeah, I know. That's my favorite. I mean, that might be my favorite quote ever.
I mean, you're trying to lure in teenagers to this, what is essentially a biblical epic. And I don't understand where the logic is in that one.
God. All right.
So,
well,
yeah.
Ben-Hur, and we'll talk about its success at the box office. What's the budget on this one, Eric?
$100
million. Yeah, okay, $100 million right down the Bemis. All right. All right, hey, speaking of Bemises, Eric, why don't you tell us about War Dogs?
Okay, so we were going from the director of Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter to Todd Phillips.
Okay. Yeah, so it's clearly not a step up. We're going sideways here.
Yeah, lateral at best.
Yeah.
At best. Might even be a step down. But War Dogs, based on a true story, Miles Teller plays a guy who is he's got a great girlfriend and is about to have a baby. But he's only selling bed sheets and trying to sell bed sheets to retirement homes. And things aren't really working being a traveling salesman. Then he ends up reconnecting with an old friend of his from a long time ago, played by Jonah Hill, who has become very industrious in the arms market. And that he's figured out there's a loophole involved where, thanks to was it George W. Bush or George H.W. Bush? One of those guys, one of the Bushes, created a loophole that allowed basically private markets to private sellers to sell arms to anyone who within the government who has the means to do it. So he brings in Miles Teller to be his partner, and they rise up the ranks, even going so far to actually running guns through what was known as the Triangle of Death in the Middle East to get it to some American general there for his troops, and then so they could train Afghanis. You have this sort of this typical story that is, you know, your rags to riches, and, you know, anyone who has seen any movie like this in the past knows that, you know, partnerships tend to go by the wayside when it comes to business and ego and drugs and all those kind of things. And that's basically all you have here. A movie that starts off with a very interesting premise, and actually a very, you know, a pretty interesting prologue, in that, you know, equating war with big business, which, you know, is kind of what it has been for a very long time behind the scenes, and just kind of squandering the opportunity to create what I think is a thoroughly mediocre film. And when I use the words thoroughly mediocre in the canon of Todd Phillips, that's actually kind of a step up for this guy. And that I didn't find this movie pretty really aggressively bad or, you know, really interesting beyond the opening stuff. It just kind of lays there, and it just kind of tells this very familiar story. You know exactly where it's headed from, you know, the minute these two guys get together. And there are no surprises. There are no twists. Bradley Cooper comes in for a couple scenes and, you know, is pretty much the best thing in the movie. Jonah Hill is just doing a really annoying version of the Jonah Hill characters that he's played in movies like Superbad and even The Wolf of Wall Street. Miles Teller is just not the kind of guy that you want to be playing your straight man character. He's just really not that interesting beyond anything he's done in Whiplash. I sat there just kind of blank throughout the movie, just like not really hating it, certainly not liking it, and by the end of it, learned absolutely nothing about this potentially really fascinating story. And it's just, you know, any director who had any sort of grasp on storytelling or just a better interest in the material rather than just doing it sort of another variation of, you know, kind of frat boys getting involved in over their heads, might have, you know, turned this into something really interesting. But it's Todd Phillips, and he doesn't have a grasp on anything that's interesting with filmmaking. So there you go.
All right. Eric, Colin, hang on, okay, guys?
Mm-hmm.
We'll get Colin's thoughts on War Dogs and my thoughts on War Dogs coming up right after we take a break here. And we've got one more movie to talk about after that, and that's Kubo and the Two Strings. And then we'll talk box office as well. All right, but we're going to break right here. Morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Tribune Tower, here till 5 a.m. And it is Monday, and that means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews, and they continue. We have just heard, before the break, Eric tell us about War Dogs, which is the new comedy from director Todd Phillips, which features Jonah Hill and Miles Teller. And he was not a fan. We welcome the guys back. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
All right. And Colin, why don't you give us your take on War Dogs?
Yeah, well, I'm with Eric on this one, perhaps not surprisingly, because this is the work of a director who is trying really hard to make a serious film and make the leap into a serious subject. In doing so, really all he's doing is a bad Martin Scorsese imitation. He watched a lot of Scorsese movies. He's trying to use narration the way Scorsese does in, you know, Goodfellas and Casino and Wolf of Wall Street. He tries to freeze frame at a time he thinks Scorsese would freeze frame during a sequence. And he's trying to use music the way he thinks Scorsese would use music. But instead, he's doing it in a really obvious way, you know, using songs like Fortunate Son and putting a Who song in, you know, when something tragic is happening, or playing Everybody Knows during the end credits. You know, this is kind of becoming a trend now. We saw it a couple weeks ago at Suicide Squad. You know, if we just pepper the soundtrack every 5 minutes, if we just put the needle down on a classic rock song and use it ironically or semi-artistically, people will be suckered into it and it'll make the movie good. That's not happening here. It didn't happen then either. I like Miles Teller as an actor, but I think it's an odd choice to have him narrate the film when he and Jonah Hill sound alike. I mean, it is him narrating, but at times, there were many times when I was thinking, who is actually narrating here? I had to, like, train my ear to figure out who it actually was.
They sound so much alike. And there's really not a whole lot of chemistry between the two of them. It feels like, you know, they just kind of met on the set that day and are still trying to kind of feel their way through the roles and trying to, you know, they're trying to have chemistry, but it's just not coming off. And so you don't really believe that Miles Teller would go along with everything Jonah Hill is throwing at him. So that part of the movie doesn't work. And it just kind of feels like, you know, this story that we have seen many times, and because it's true, therefore it will be interesting and we won't have to do much of anything else to make it a better film. We saw that a couple months ago with The Infiltrator. We see it quite a bit lately. We saw it definitely a lot last year during award season with movies like Trumbo. And it's a trend that is really getting annoying. And these kind of stories should really be left to directors who can really put an interesting spin on it. And even Scorsese can't, you know, do much more with it than he did with Wolf of Wall Street, which wasn't much, even though I still kind of find the movie entertaining. So this is the movie that it's trying really hard, and it's not totally unwatchable, but it's also not very memorable either.
Yeah, yeah, you know, the key word here, and Eric, you've used it, and Colin, you've used it, and I'm going to use it too, is trying. And that just seems like the repetitive thing that you can describe all of Todd Phillips' movies. I don't know if you guys agree with me or not, but he seems like a guy who's trying to do this and trying to do that and not succeeding. You know, the Hangover movies seem like a desperate attempt for a guy to make like a, you know, I'm going to make like the ultimate, you know, R-rated raunch comedy. And it seems pretty pathetic. The only movie that Todd Phillips directed that I have I didn't hate this one. It's bad. It's certainly not worth seeing. But is Old School. Is the only, he did Old School, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Probably a half hour.
About a half of that movie is pretty funny, and then it falls completely apart. But, like, over the guy's not a good filmmaker. He's a terrible filmmaker. And this is a movie that shows his limitations, that shows off his limitations massively. And Colin, you nailed it right on the head when it's this guy trying to do Scorsese. This is him desperately trying, again, the word trying, desperately trying to be taken seriously as a filmmaker. To the point where even the ad campaigns for his movies reek of desperation. You know what I mean? It's just like when you bill yourself as the director of the Hangover trilogy. And I remember feeling the same way about Due Date. Like the ad campaign seemed like, look, I'm Todd Phillips and I'm going to force myself on you. And by doing this style and doing these ad campaigns and forcing my credits or my name upon the film, I will be taken seriously as a filmmaker, damn it. And he just doesn't have the talent to back it up. You know, it the movie feels as though it wants to be taken very seriously. And I think in the hands of somebody else, it could have been taken seriously because it's a really interesting story. It's based on a story that I actually read in Rolling Stone, which was a really beautifully written thing. And I don't know how many people wrote the screenplay for this movie? Was it like five people or something?
Three people are credited.
Okay. Because it feels like it's been rewritten 100 times. It feels like it's, and I don't know if that has anything, because Todd Phillips has a writing credit on it, I think, as well. But it feels like it's a movie that has way, way, way too many hands on it. And way too many writers, and it was rewritten a bunch of times, and I don't know how many drafts they did. And I totally agree, Colin, about the fact that there's absolutely no chemistry between Jonah Hill and Miles Teller. None. And when you can have Jonah Hill in a movie with someone like Brad Pitt, and they get marvelous chemistry out of that, because that's an odd couple right there. And if you can have Jonah Hill in a movie with Leonardo DiCaprio, which is an even odder pairing, and to get good chemistry out of that, well, of course, that Scorsese directed that, so that explains that. But to put Jonah Hill and Miles Teller together, there's nothing there. There's absolutely nothing there. There's no comedic timing. There's no chemistry. You don't get the idea that these guys are friends. You just don't. And at every moment in the movie, and you're absolutely right, Colin, at every moment in the movie, it just reminds you of better movies. Not necessarily all Scorsese, although that's clearly clearly the biggest and number one influence on Phillips here, but other filmmakers who could have done a better job with this. When I think of, like, serious political satire, the guy who directed The Hangover is not the first guy that pops up on my list.
Well, I think a director has done a good movie on this subject, and that was Andrew Niccol with The Lord of War.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly, which is a terrific movie. If you've not seen this movie, listen, it's Nicolas Cage, I know. Don't let that...
Before he got all cagey.
Right, and then Jared Leto is in it as well before he got all method.
Leto, yeah.
That's a terrific movie, by the way, Lord of War. When did that come out? That was like in the mid-2000s, right?
2001? Was it 2005?
Yeah, 2005.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm glad you brought that up, Colin, because that's a much better movie. That's also a funny movie, but it really deals with this topic, a similar topic, in a much better way, directed by someone who can actually direct a movie, as opposed to Todd Phillips, who can't. I'm looking at the IMDb page for it. You know, just the font makes me mad. You know what I mean? I'm looking at the poster is like a takeoff off Scarface. You know,
the font is a Reservoir Dogs font.
Exactly. It's just like everything about what this guy does is like, you will take me seriously because I will remind you of other things. I don't know, man. He just bugs me. His movies just bug me. And I'm actually, you know, I know, Eric, you're not a Miles Teller fan. I am.
No.
I am. And it's not just Whiplash. I've liked him in many movies. But there's nothing here. There's absolutely nothing here. All right. Eric, Colin, hang out. Okay, guys?
Okay.
All right. We got to take a break for the news. When we come back, we got one more movie to talk about. And it's Kubo and the Two Strings. And we'll talk about that right after we take a break for the news, which is next right here on WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Here till 5, I'm your overnight dude, 2 to 5 every weekday morning. It is Monday morning. That means it is time for the Monday morning movie reviews. Not a lot of movies to talk about this week, just one more to review. And then Eric and I will talk about the box office as well. And, we've got the Monday morning joke from my dad. My dad will call in because it's a jokey time. That's coming up. We are also going to talk about the best live acts in terms of rock and roll, best live musicians, best live bands. In honor of the tremendous show that I saw Saturday night at Wrigley Field with Pearl Jam. And Pearl Jam, by the way, playing Wrigley Field again tonight. And if you're going, you're in store for a pretty amazing show, if it's anything like what they did Saturday night. So we're going to talk about best live acts and music. So all that is coming up right here. You can call in at 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. You can also check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show, and Facebook is our best way to stay connected, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Like us now. All right, let's get back to the movie reviews with Eric Childress and Colin Suter, and we welcome back, guys. Welcome back.
Hey, thank you.
All right, Colin, tell us about Kubo and the Two Strings.
All right. Well, this is the latest from Laika Animation Studios, the stop-motion animation studio that gave us Coraline, Paranorman, and the Box Trolls. And this one is steeped in Japanese folklore and tells the story of a boy named Kubo who can tell stories in the village squares using his guitar and little origami characters that act them out. And he lives with his mom in a cave on the outskirts of this town, and she's very protective of him, doesn't want him to leave the homeland. But there are evil spirits who are after Kobe and his mother. And once they appear, Kobe finds himself in, long story short, finds himself in another part of the world away from his mother and joined by a monkey voiced by Charlize Theron. And then later on by a samurai bug voiced by Matthew McConaughey. And from there, it follows a typical hero's quest. As they try to track down this suit of armor that will help Kubo defeat the evil spirits. They have to track down the body armor, the sword, and I believe the helmet. So there are elements of Star Wars. There's elements of Clash of the Titans and just elements of all kinds of mythology and folklore kind of peppered throughout the whole storyline of this thing. As a quest fantasy film, this is a really just a beautiful piece of work that I just kind of drank in. Leica Studios is one of my favorite studios, my favorite group of filmmakers out there today. One of the things I love about their work is they're not afraid to take young viewers to the darker side of things. And they're not afraid to be a little scary. They're not afraid to take chances and go to the part of storytelling that maybe Pixar or DreamWorks, you know, ignore a little too often, while at the same time being very engaging and very funny. The Matthew McConaughey's character brings some wonderful humor to the piece. And Charlize Theron, I'm guessing she recorded her voice while still in production on Mad Max, because you hear a little Furiosa in there, which I'm so okay with. You know, it's a great vocal performance and a beautiful, you know, like, I mean, all the characterizations of this movie are just beautiful. You know, I don't know how they do it. You know, it's one of those movies I watch. I don't know how they do it where they just get these little nuanced, you know, emotions from these characters that are, you know, made of sticks and rubber and God knows what else.
Now, we should explain, Colin, explain the process by which they make these movies, because it's not the same as the computer generated stuff that, you know, that everybody else is doing now. It's a different process. You might want to explain it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, this is basically like claymation in a way, you know, like those, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you know, that whole thing, you know, that we watch every year, or think of something like Chicken Run or Wallace and Gromit. It's like that, basically, but they're not clay. They're made up of other materials. But, you know, the reason why, you know, these movies are worth the extra, you know, admission price for the 3D is because these are animated movies that are made, you know, in a three-dimensional way.
Yeah, that's right.
They're not on a computer screen. These are real objects that you're looking at interacting with other real objects with real background, you know, mostly real backgrounds. There's some green screen in there, but there's a real tangibility to this thing, to these movies. And that's what makes them really special as animated, you know, products. And, you know, we'll talk about this in the box office, but it drives me nuts. I mean, I'm glad Leica has a home with a studio, but I just wish it wasn't Focus Features. I wish it was a studio that really knew how to release a film and really get it out there and market it well. But Focus can't do that with even their live-action stuff. It's another story. But this is really one of my favorite films of the year, definitely one of the top two films of the summer. I can't encourage people enough to go see it. It is wonderful and exciting and funny and beautiful, and get the 3D because you won't be sorry.
Okay. Eric?
Yeah, man. I had some of the same just joyful just watching this thing that I had with Peach Dragon last week.
2 weeks in a row. 2 weeks in a row. And let me say something. These movies aren't making a lot of money, and we'll get to that but you know, they're the two best family films of the summer, without question. And not a lot of people are going to see them. Meanwhile, you know, like mediocre stuff is making hundreds of millions of dollars in terms of, you know, what they're aiming at kids. And you've got two movies like this, Pete's Dragon, and especially this one, that are extraordinarily special. And everyone and every kid should see them. I'm sorry to interrupt, Eric, but I'm very
it should be said, and we'll talk about we'll express a little more anger during the box office on this very topic. But you know, everything Colin said about it is, you know, is certainly echoed here. And one of the things that he brought up is, you know, that, you know, they go to places that, like Colin said, a lot of these other family films do not go to. I mean, the third act of this movie is actually very challenging, in the way the story is told. I mean, I think I heard a couple kids in the audience when I saw it last night go like, "What was happening?" Like, I mean, I think that, you know, parents are going to have to take time to explain certain things, and that's probably a turnoff for the parents, because God forbid that they explain anything to their children these days. There are things about the plot that they might have to explain to them, but then there are more valiant things about the whole idea of this movie being about the beautification of memories. And the fact that you have one character that is dealing with, whether it be Alzheimer's, dementia, or, you know, just flat out amnesia, is really challenging stuff. And to sort of to bring everything full circle and to talk about how,
you know, everything that, you know, has existed at one time and has been loved at one time is because of memories. And, you know, and which is a sort of a really interesting statement on, you know, when we're talking about the box office, is that movies like this are going to have to, you know, exist and they're loved because of memories. You know, it's like we're going to have to tell people about these movies. And that, you know, that there was one time when movies like Pete's Dragon and Kubo and The Two Strings came out and nobody went to see them. That doesn't mean that they weren't any good because they didn't make any the same kind of money that Secret Life of Stupid Pets made. But it's just the way it is. And it's unfortunate that the two best family films of the year are basically having to compete against each other. Now, at the end of the summer, when kids are back in school, we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. But, no, the animation of this movie is beautiful. The voice work is great. Charlize Theron is doing some terrific stuff here. McConaughey is hilarious in this movie. And the story is beautiful. The mythology is beautiful. The action set pieces in this thing, the sequence where they're trying to get the sword from the skeleton.
Yeah.
Oh my God, was I just eating that one up? And then there's a battle at sea, and then there's another battle during the third act, and I was really emotional during this thing, and just like Colin said, you just kind of drink this all in. And by the end of it, you don't really want it to end. You just want it to keep going, and then you just want, when it's done, you want to tell everybody in the world about it. It's one of the best movies of the summer and of the year.
Yeah. Okay. All right, we got a break. I want to come back and I'll give you my review, and then I want to talk a little bit more about Kubo, and to remind everybody a little bit more about Pete's Dragon, since we got a little extra time this morning. I would like to dedicate it to these, you know, these movies, so that, you know, families go. I mean, it's out there, so go see it. So hang on, guys. When we come back from the break, I will give you my review of Kubo and The Two Strings, and then we'll talk a little bit more about Pete's Dragon as well. Both movies not making a lot of money. Both movies aimed at families, and families should see them, and we'll talk more about that coming up. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower, and we're reviewing the movies. It's Monday morning, and that means movie reviews. Eric Childress, Colin Suter, and I are reviewing the movies. And we are in the middle of talking about an incredibly special film called Kubo and the Two Strings. Eric, Colin, welcome back.
Thank you. Hello.
I would like to echo everything that Eric and Colin said. I think this is a magnificent piece of work. The artistry on display in this film is breathtaking. There are sequences that just, emotionally, this movie has a lot of stuff going on. This is a very, very deep and significant film. It's about families. It's about memories. It's about death. And just the psychological implications of these three main characters, and what they discover about themselves and their relationships is so powerful. I mean, so powerful. But there's just a lot of stuff going on. But the artistry on display adds to it. Like, this movie is so beautiful to watch, like breathtaking. And I saw it in 3D as well. Eric, I'm assuming, did you see it in 3D?
No, I did not, actually.
It's the 3D is magnificent. And Colin, you would agree?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, there are sequences in this movie outside of the fact that I became emotionally involved in this kid's story and his family, and, you know, the makeshift family that he has while he's on this adventure, and what that makeshift family actually turns out to be, which is also, you know, just devastatingly emotional. Just looking at this movie made me cry. There were sequences in this movie that were so gorgeous, that were breathtakingly beautiful. And the artistry and the time that it took, that these artists dedicate to bringing this vision to life, made me cry. I'm like, this is amazing work. Like, artistry on a level that doesn't exist nowadays, you know? And that's how I felt about all of the films that this studio has put together. I don't know if this one's my favorite. I love them all, but I don't know if this one's my favorite, only because Paranorman is just so close to, like, a personal like a personal, sure, personal experience for me, you know? But this thing is magnificent on so many levels. As you said, Eric, and Colin, there are action sequences in this movie that are mind-boggling, that are beautiful. It's exciting. It's funny. There's an emotional payoff that's massive at the end of this movie. Like, I was crying my eyes out at the end of this film. There's also a really kick-ass version of While My Guitar Gently Weeps, which plays at the end of the film by Regina Spektor, which ruled and added more to it. You mentioned the voice work. Charlize Theron is phenomenal as Monkey in this. Phenomenal. And I agree with you, Colin. I have a feeling that she recorded her stuff while she was making Fury Road. I really, and I thought about that too, man. I thought about it while I was watching it.
It makes sense.
It absolutely makes sense. And McConaughey, really, really funny and really, really nice. And when his character has a discovery very late in the film, he handles it beautifully. But it is just so great. I don't know. I just was like, I was floating when it was over. I was on cloud nine when it ended, and it's absolutely one of my favorite films of the year. Now, just to remind everybody really quickly a little bit, Eric, tell us a little bit about just a very, very quick synopsis and what you thought of Pete's Dragon, because this is the other great family movie that's out there that nobody's going to see. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, well, I mean, Pete's Dragon, I mean, it's a remake of the 1977 film, very loose remake in that the story of Pete, who's been, his family is killed in a car accident on vacation, and he ends up being in the woods surviving in the woods for several years with his new friend, a dragon, who befriends him. And years pass, and there are rumors of this dragon being out there. And then the boy is discovered and is sort of reassimilated back into society, while his connection with the dragon still exists. And so people want to catch the dragon. The boy wants to be reunited with the dragon. Quite simply, this is a movie that, again, is going to be, I believe, passed down in generations if people see it. Movies like E.T. and The Iron Giant and The Black Stallion. It's that level of emotional family filmmaking. I think it's one of the best movies of the year.
Yeah. And Colin, you agree?
Absolutely. This is, hiring a director who clearly has the heart and the brain to put a movie like this together and have it be emotionally rewarding and beautiful to look at and so well acted and great use of music and just, a really beautiful take on a film that should be remade because it sucked the first time. And this is just a beautiful, beautiful film. And, can't ask for a better double feature out there right now. A Day at the Movies and going to see Pete's Dragon and Kubo and the Two Strings.
Yeah, I echo that completely. Pete's Dragon is a wonderful movie and one of the biggest surprises of the, not just the summer, but of the entire year. I still remember seeing the original Pete's Dragon in 1977. I was 12 years old, and I was like, what is this crap? And, when I heard they were remaking it, I thought it was a bad idea, and I just didn't expect much from this movie. And it is beautiful. It is a wonderful family movie. And as you guys said, it absolutely deserves to be compared in the same breath as stuff like E.T. and The Iron Giant. It's that good. It is a terrific, terrific film. Nobody's really going to see it, so there won't be lines. You'll be able to get a ticket, take the family to it, and also as we mentioned, the new film that came out this week, Kubo and the Two Strings, another great. Great family film. And we wanted to focus, or at least I did, I wanted to focus on these two movies because not a lot of people are seeing them. And everybody sometimes complains about the kind of stuff that you can take kids to nowadays. And that's a justifiable, complaint. I'm sure you guys would agree that, there's stuff out there for kids, there's a lot of, like, I've noticed that there has to be pee jokes and everything now. The Angry Birds movie. And I saw the trailer for Storks, and there were, like, two pee jokes in the trailer for Storks, and which actually Storks looks pretty funny, and it's actually from people that I like, but I was just pointing that out, that there's nothing like that in Pete's Dragon, and there's nothing like that in Kubo. I mean, these are pure, wonderful pieces of family entertainment that are put together by people who care, by true artists, and it's the kind of family entertainment that that families deserve but are not going to. You're going to get mediocre stuff like What Are the Pets Doing? You're going to get that, which I didn't hate. I found it entertaining, but it's nowhere near the level of artistry in Pete's Dragon and especially in Kubo. So families, go see these movies. So I just wanted to take a little time to talk about that. I'm sure you guys are okay with that.
Yes, totally. Absolutely.
All right, cool. What do we got next week?
Well, we got Don't Breathe.
All right.
Next week. And then you got Hands of Stone.
Which is the Roberto Duran docu.
Correct.
Docudrama.
No, docu-drama. It's not. Drama.
Yeah.
Definitely not a documentary.
No.
And Mechanic Resurrection.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
It's the end of August, isn't it?
It is. Yep. Happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day, everybody. Enjoy the Jason Statham remake, sequel to the remake of a movie where the character gets killed at the end.
Yeah.
So there you go. All
That's
right.
Resurrection.
That's Resurrection. Okay, good. You can't kill Statham. Everybody should know that. You've seen Spy. You can't kill Statham. All right. All right, Colin, thank you, my friend.
All righty.
We will talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
Eric, you hang on.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will talk about the box office with Eric Childress, who does a piece about box office analysis and all that stuff. You can check it out at movies.com. We're going to take a break here, and we'll come back. And we've got Erica will stick around and talk about box office. All right, Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Yeah, man. All right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're here till 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude. Steve Grzanich will have the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 on this Monday morning. And it is Monday. So that means my dad will be calling in to tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we are going to be talking about some of the best live bands or live artists that you've ever seen in concert. I went to see Pearl Jam over the weekend at Wrigley Field, and it was amazing, absolutely amazing. They're playing again tonight at Wrigley, and if you have tickets, you're lucky because you're going to see something amazing and awesome. So we're going to talk about some of the best live bands and live music ever and your favorite concerts. You can participate by texting or calling us at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. All right, we did the movie reviews this week. Go see Kubo and the Two Strings, for God's sake. Go take your kids, take everybody. It is a magnificent movie. And now we're going to talk about the box office. Eric Childress joins me. Eric, welcome back, man.
Thank you.
And tell everybody how they can see you on the TVs.
Yeah, every Thursday morning at 5 a.m. on Business First AM on WYCC. Yeah, so set your DVRs for every Thursday morning.
And yeah, you talk about the box office.
Yes.
And break it all down. Well, let's do this. So, Suicide Squad number 1, $20.7 million, bringing its total up to $262.2 million. What do these numbers mean, especially the weekend, 20 million?
Well, it dropped another 52%, which is pretty much one in line with what the Batman and the Superman was doing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers, you know, they look good, and it's sort of in the same on the same pace that the Twilight films were, and the Twilight films did not break $300 million. So I'm still sticking by my guns that it's going to come up probably just shy of $300 million. Right now, it's on pace for between 295-298 million right now.
Mm-hmm.
It could break 300, but the thing is that, you know, again, people are still reporting that this thing needs to break 750 worldwide to break even, and it's at 572 right now. If it's only going to make 30 to 40 more million in the U.S., it's still got another 140 to make up overseas, and I don't think it's going to do that.
All right. And then Sausage Party took a pretty big drop this week. Sausage Party, $15.3 million. What's the deal with that, and what do you project that's going to do?
Well, this was a surprise for me. I mean, I said last week that I thought Sausage Party was going to overtake Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
It was the biggest surprise to me is exactly just how far it actually dropped, because day by day during the week, it was actually inching up closer and closer to Suicide Squad, and I thought by the weekend it was going to overtake it, but it ended up dropping big, but you know this movie only cost $19 million to make, And even if, I mean, the film doesn't make a dime overseas, it's made a couple million. This thing is probably going to pan out somewhere around 90 million, probably.
Yeah.
And, I mean, on a $19 million budget, that's a solid hit for Sony.
Absolutely. I mean, if it's only a $19 million budget, it's already at $65
million. Right.
You know, and it's still got a couple of more weeks in it.
Mm-hmm.
No question about it. Is it, you think it dropped because it's, you know, because it's got a limited audience in terms of R rating? And maybe like you were suggesting last week that people were buying tickets to PG movies and going to see that.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, you get a lot of stuff opening this weekend. Now that, you know, the Kubo, you know, animated film wasn't going to take people away from it. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, even if people say how much they love this movie, and clearly there is a lot of word of mouth out there that people are, you know, really think this movie is very funny.
Yeah.
You know, it's still an animated film, and people might just want to be holding off for it. I mean, but I mean, $15.3 million, it beat all the new releases. This week.
Absolutely, yeah. And speaking of new releases, number three is War Dogs, $14.3 million. And that is kind of the same audience as Sausage Party, right? I mean, they're kind of going after, you know, the R-rated. I mean, Jonah Hill's in both of them.
Yeah, I mean, they're going. I mean, if there is such a thing as a Jonah Hill audience, I know more people that dislike Jonah Hill than actually like him.
Right.
And you know, I don't think people are really, you know, suckered in by, you know, oh, the guy made a Hangover, did a movie about arms dealing. But you know, but I mean, it was well advertised enough to beat out the other two movies this weekend,
mm-hmm.
and it's, you know, it's a $40 million budget, which is too high for a movie like this.
Sure.
And apparently another $40 million in advertising. So you're looking at this movie's going to, you know, do at least $160 million worldwide to break even. And it's probably not going to do much more than maybe $40 here in the U.S.
Yeah. And now, was this expected? Did you think $14 million was right around how much it was going to make?
Yeah, I was thinking somewhere between $13 and $15 million.
Yeah. All right. And then number four is Kubo and the Two Strings, which only made $12.6 million, and it's a damn tragedy as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Focus has been opening the Leica movies in August. They released Paranorman then. They released Box Trolls in September. And these movies have made, I mean, Coraline did $75 million. And Paranorman and Box Trolls did in the between $50 and $60 million. But I mean, here's an even greater tragedy. None of these Leica movies have grossed $150 million worldwide.
None of them.
None of them. Not Coraline. Not Paranorman. You know, I don't. Kubo probably not. But Planes, Fire, and Rescue did.
Oh God.
Okay, so that's, you know, when we get angry about this stuff, everyone, this is the kind of stuff we're talking about.
Oh,
you know,
it's just so depressing.
Really is. It's a dang tragedy that a movie like this is. You know, I mean, this film could stretch. You know, this film could find an audience, but you know, it's again. Colin is right in suggesting that Focus is probably, you know, is not helping the situation, but at the same time, where else is this? Are these movies going to go?
Yeah,
you know, these are animated films that clearly have a greater artistry than sort of the product, you know, which a lot of these animation departments from other studios are putting out. You look at Storks, you look at Trolls. Did you see the preview for Trolls?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
What the hell is that? What the hell is that?
Yeah. What about the other one? Did you see the preview? Did you see the trailer for The Wildlife?
No, but I that was supposed to open in May. And was originally just called Robinson Crusoe.
Right. Now it's called The Wildlife. It looks horrible.
Yeah. Well, I think it's – I'll have to double check. I think it might be the same people who did, like, The Legends of Oz.
Oh.
I think it's that same – you know, so, again, there's another, you know.
Yeah. And that'll probably end up making more money than Kubo.
No, it won't.
I hope not. God, I hope not.
I promise you that won't happen.
Okay. All right.
But
so that's,
there will be people that take their movie to
take their kids,
take
to,
their
see
kids
it,
to
yeah.
that who did not go see Pete's Dragon or Kubo.
Right. All right. Number five, the best idea of the year, Ben-Hur, $11.3 million. Yeah. What did Paramount think was going to happen?
I don't know.
I mean,
I honestly don't know, because even if they thought, I mean, people, the studios, whoever's thinking that, you know, I mean, the faith-based crowd that they were going for, that's the kind of thing that they were ended up eventually shifting the marketing to. They have to realize that the faith-based crowd is going after more personal stories.
Right.
They're going after stories like Heaven is for Real and Miracles from Heaven, and even stuff like, you know, War Room and Courageous and, you know, Kirk Cameron's Fireproof and stuff like that. You know, I mean, these are movies that, you know, God's Not Dead, not another one. You know, movies that have a really small budget and, you know, are marketed specifically to that audience. And you know, people, those go out and see it. And Ben-Hur is, looks, you know, is trying to, you know, have it, you know, have its cake and eat it too,
right.
by, you know, marketing to the faith-based people, but promoting it like you said, like Gladiator meets Fast and the Furious.
Yeah.
And I mean, people, you know, even the faith-based crowd aren't stupid. They know what Ben-Hur is,
right?
You know, they've seen Ben-Hur. They know what that story is. And, you know, it's the same reason that, you know, the Exodus didn't do very well a few years ago. Who wanted to see another version of the Ten Commandments?
Right, right. So that's number five, and that'll drop huge.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Number six, as we mentioned before, The Great Pete's Dragon, $11.3 million, and it's only made $42 million in 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's it dropped bigger. It dropped 47%, dropped much bigger than I thought it would. And that's really because of Kubo. I mean, even though it seems like no one went and saw Kubo, that's your Pete's Dragon audience right there.
Yeah.
You know, so they took their kids to see Kubo this week instead of Pete's Dragon. I think both those the drops next week will be a lot lighter.
Yeah.
I mean, there's certainly no kids movies opening next week. But, you know, it's going to kind of dribble their way towards like 60 and, you know, maybe 35, 40 million.
Yeah. Okay. I do want to mention one of the most entertaining moments of going to see Kubo. Was the father and his two daughters were sitting behind me, and the daughters were probably between 5 and 8, you know, around that. I think there were three daughters, and the guy, the father who took them, they were sitting behind us. And during the trailers, you know, they showed the trailer for Monster Trucks.
Yes.
Which, hey, you know what?
It doesn't look terrible.
No, it's – I will – you know what? We always bitch about originality in movies. This is about, like, an alien that lives in a truck and drives it.
Mm-hmm.
And Jane Levy's in it. So I'm already like, well, I'm going.
Right.
But it was so funny. Like, as soon as the trailer ended – oh, no, I'm sorry. I should set this up a little bit earlier. They showed a trailer for something else. I can't remember what it was. It was probably Trolls or Storks or whatever. So they show the trailer, and one of the little girls goes Daddy, can we see that? And he's like, yeah, we can see. And you could see that, you could just tell by the way he was like talking that he was a little bit exasperated already, because I guess I would imagine with three daughters, you take them to the movie, they're going to ask you after every trailer if they can see it.
Right.
You know? So this guy is like, yeah, we can see it. And so they showed another trailer for another kids movie or whatever, and one of the girls goes, yeah, Dad, can we see it? And he's like, yeah, fine, whatever. You know, well, I'll take you to see it. You know, just shut up and, you know, eat your popcorn. And then the trailer for Monster Trucks comes on. And it ends, and before the daughters say anything, the guy goes, not a chance. I almost fell off my chair. Not a chance. I was
that's
like,
great.
That's fantastic. And then to round out the top 10, Bad Moms is 7, Jason Bourne 8, Secret Life of Pets still in there.
Yep.
And then Florence Foster Jenkins comes in at number 10. So what do we think is going to happen next week?
I think by default, I think Don't Breathe is going to take it.
Okay.
I mean, Jason Statham movies don't really do particularly well.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone knows what Hands of Stone is.
Yeah.
So I think just the horror, you know, Don't Breathe is obviously a horror film marketed to the horror crowd.
Right.
And they have been showing up. I mean, Conjuring 2, Lights Out have done very well this summer.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, maybe it's not a huge 20 million type opening, but I think mid-teens,
well,
I think 15, 16 million will be enough to win next week.
They are saturating the market, man. Every time I turn on a TV and watch a show, there's a commercial for Don't Breathe, especially if it's like a Comedy Central channel or, you know, the channels that are aimed a little bit at the younger crowd or quote unquote hipper crowd or whatever. There's a Don't Breathe commercial every 15 minutes. So,
yeah, I think it's very possible it could take the box office for, you got another horror movie opening on September 2nd called Morgan.
Right.
That's getting advertised. But I think Don't Breathe is a pretty easy winner next week.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. I'm really looking forward to it. And
you're going to lose your mind.
Yeah. It's not just the advertising, but there's a lot of great word of mouth, and the reviews have been, the reviews that are trickling in have all been positive, like really, really positive. So, all right, that's what we got to look forward to next week. Eric, always a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Sure thing.
All right, take care. You can check out Eric at efilmcritic.com, rogerebert.com, and you can read his box office analysis in detail at movies.com.